Welcome to The Thal Project. I'm your host, Saya the Jaffer. The Thal Project is a mini-series that explores Thal, also known as lentils or legumes, and the rich and diverse ways that people of the South Asian diaspora cook it. It's also about storytelling, memory, migration, and culture.
Today I welcome Shobana Xavier, professor in religious studies at Queen's University. She shares with me Parpu curry, a Tamil Sri Lankan red lentil curry, as well as reflections on her family's migration to Canada from Sri Lanka at a time of civil war.
So my name is Shobana Xavier. I am originally from Jaffna, Sri Lanka, and I came to Canada when I was, 5 or 6 years old. I moved to Montreal first, and from Montreal came to Toronto, went to university there. Ended up being a teacher, primary school teacher, traveled a little bit, came back and did my PhD at Wilfrid Laurier University, moved around for 3 years teaching in the U.S. And it was really in the U.S. when I really started thinking about food, because it was the first time I was away from home. And so I was feeling deeply nostalgic and did not have access to my usual foods. And so the lack of it is what made me think a little bit about it. And every time I would go home to Scarborough for holidays or school breaks, I would just like be really missing my mom's food in particular. I wouldn't consider myself an amazing cook, partly because my mother is an amazing cook. But since moving to Kingston, where I am living now, I have tried to start cooking a little bit more. I think because of COVID, I wasn't able to go to Scarborough as much, and often trying to replicate my mom's cuisine, even though she's not always really good about transmitting them to me. I just generally love food. I love Sri Lankan food, thinking a lot about it.
So what are we going to be making today?
So this is called Parpu curry. So that's red lentil, but that's what we say in Sri Lanka. I'm particularly Tamil, so I don't know if Parpu has like a Tamil. It might, but I actually don't know. So just red lentil curry, and it's probably one of the easiest ones we were told to make. And so, yeah, I grew up eating this a lot. We'd always have it with rice, and Sri Lankan Tamil food has, like, often rice and a lot of different sides. So usually have, like, this as a side, a curry, like a spicy curry as a side, and maybe some, like, more vegetables. So usually it's kind of like a lunchtime thing, but there'd always be lots left over in the fridge that you might eat it with toast maybe the next morning, or you might eat it with rice or any of the other things that are common. So this is kind of a staple, I would say. So I think the recipe is basically simple from what I understand. So this is like a mix of what I do. It's like a cup of red lentils that I've just soaked and washed, so the water is generally clear. First, we're just kind of gonna add water to it, but there's a bunch of other things you add to make it fancy. So some tomatoes. You could do red onion, shallots. Regular onion is totally fine, so you're just throwing that in there. Some garlic, which I think I did 3 small cloves, and I minced them. Green chilies, I took out the seeds, so it's not too spicy. So I deseeded it, and I just also cut them. And this is about just one. So these are the spices. So usually what we do is the turmeric for us is the most important part. So this is 1 tablespoon of turmeric. This cumin, 1 tablespoon. Coriander, 1/2 tablespoon. The chili is kind of to your spice level. And usually I would use Kashmiri chili powder, but I don't have any. I looked in my cupboard and I was like, oh no. So this is just cayenne pepper and then some salt as well. So all of this stuff is just going in. And then basically what we're going to do, all of it is just in one pot. We're adding 1.5 cups of water, and we'll just let it boil in on the stove. And that's kind of it. A lot of Sri Lankan food really likes coconut milk. And so that's the one thing we'll add here, which is to add coconut milk if you want it a little bit creamy. And you can add some curry leaves too, actually, I provide. There'll be like 2 stages of curry leaves, one that could go to like kind of the boiling process, and another that would be the tempering process. So. And Sri Lankan food also really loves curry leaves as well. So that's just on the stove, and we'll just let it boil. And the second part of this is the tempering. And I love tempering. It's probably one of my favorite things with generally South Asian cooking.
What do you love about it?
I don't know. I just love the mustard seeds on the hot oil bouncing. I think it's just very fun. And I don't think a lot of cuisines do tempering. I think a lot of South Asian cuisine does tempering. And so one of the things is that once this is all done, boiled through, you add oil and mustard seeds, cumin seeds, and then just the chili, one whole chili.
One dried red chili.
Yeah, exactly. And then the important part is also the curry leaves. So you'll do like a spring of it. So maybe like 5 or 6 leaves. And that gets all just tempered or like tossed in oil, and it'll just bounce for a little bit, and it'll be a really nice fragrance in the kitchen. And you just kind of take it and pour it over the end product of what's been boiling.
So you mentioned that using coconut milk is a common ingredient used a lot in Sri Lankan cooking. Why is that?
Partly because we have a lot of coconut trees, especially in the north. And they're like palmera trees. In Sri Lanka, what you do is you husk the actual coconut, and then the husk, the outer layer, gets used for lots of other things, but usually for fire. So in the olden days, that would have been one of the ways they would use fire to do stove cooking outside, because people would not have had actual stoves indoors. One of the things I remember as a child, I remember at my grandfather's funeral, everybody gathers around, like food is really important. My aunt and my mom had sat me down on the floor, and they gave me the coconut grinder. And so I just sat there with the coconut grinding it, and then all the ground coconut ends up in a tray, and then they would come when I was ready and pour water in it, and they would soak it through to actually make fresh coconut milk. And so that was one of the first times in my life in Scarborough that I learned how to make coconut milk, because I just thought coconut milk came from a can, right? And then until I saw my aunts, and they told me to do it because they just needed a lot of help, because it was a huge meal undertaking. And I just was sitting there, like, having experienced the whole process of grinding the coconut and then like feeling the coconut shreds in my hands and soaking it through water. And they would come and pour, steep it. And then they would keep redoing it until they had enough fresh coconut milk. So then it dawned on me at that time that that's how they grew up, having access to coconut milk, because they would actually have to do it.
They'd make it themselves.
Fresh, yeah, and not like be able to go get it from a can, right? And I've tried to do it here, where you would get one coconut. I have a grinder, but you need a lot. Like, you can't do it with one coconut, right? And
it produces a small amount of milk.
Have to be going through a lot of coconuts. And it also means that, you know, it doesn't matter who you were, but it was like something that was accessible to people. And then people would make it fresh. And there was a whole, like, really involved process, which to this day, now I appreciate more because I, like, done it the first time. So coconut milk tends to be, like, the additional piece, where I feel like a lot of South Asian cuisine doesn't do that.
My family is Gujarati and went to East Africa. I think in, like, Zanzibari and Swahili cooking, there is also coconut or coconut milk, and we definitely use it for certain kinds of dishes.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that it's pervasive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I would say, like, if there was, like, a key item or something that we use consistently, I would be like, coconut for us is like, would be the thing. Because we would drink the milk, we would eat, sometimes just eat the coconut fresh. And I think it was
delicious.
It's just very delicious. And I think I appreciate coconuts a lot more now, because I've seen the various ways in which it gets incorporated into meals and things like that.
Yeah, and how hard it is to harvest.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So you could see it's getting a little bit yellow because of the turmeric.
Yeah.
So we'll add a little bit more water, and then the last thing that we'll do to this is basically add the coconut milk before adding kind of tempering things.
It smells wonderful in here.
Yeah.
You've mentioned that this is sort of inspired by your mom's cooking, and you have described her as an excellent cook. What would be some of the kinds of characteristics of your mom's approach to cooking that you would say has influenced the way you think about food?
My sister had a baby of 2 years ago, and so I was with her and my mom. And so my mom was doing all this kitchen prep, and we were at a point in our lives where we start making notes when she makes things. Like, her shrimp curry is one of the most famous. It's, like, really good. And so we would ask her, like, how did you learn how to make this stuff? And it's actually quite tragic in many ways, because her mother died when she was, I think, in her 20s. Like, she's 21. She's quite young. And so she is the eldest female sibling in the order of, there's, like, 8 of them, I think. And so she often tells a story where when she used to go to school at the time, she would have those white uniforms. And I've gone back to her ancestral home and seen that it's just like a little outhouse at the back where you just put fire and then you cook on this kind of wooden thing. And so she would wake up early in the mornings and have to make food out of responsibility for her entire family and then run to school. And one day when she was going to school, she, I think, got like curry powder stuff on her white uniform. And she got in trouble at school. And so that was the day that she decided not to go back to school anymore. So her narrative of food has always been like, oh, it's just what I've had to do. Like, I've had to cook for them. It's duty, exactly.
An obligation.
And then we think about it now because she makes such amazing food. And I think we didn't appreciate it as when we were young kids, when we were growing up in Canada. But partly because we would come home and ask for mac and cheese, or she'd be like, what are these things, right?
I relate to all the things you're saying right now.
Yeah, because she would make these like really complicated biryani dishes or really like complicated rice or like petapakari, and then we'd be asking for these other things. And she would make those things, but it was not her flavor profile. It was hard for her, but she tried. And now that we're older, the only things we ever ask her for are these dishes, and I think she's really happy. And I think because we didn't grow up with a lot, being like new people in a new country, I think food was our way to be like, I could always make sure you're fed and you could be fed with really delicious food. And now that I'm older, I'm like super appreciative about what that has meant. So I'm just adding more water as it's boiling. And then I'm also going to add coconut milk, and that'll kind of give it the creaminess. And then we could kind of suss out if we want it to be more watery or less watery. We could either decide to add more or even like add in more coconut milk. So now I'm just turning on a second pan. This is when we're going to temper. I think we're probably aiming for like a tablespoon. And we do generally want it to be hot because you want it to temper kind of right away. So again, what we're adding is mustard seeds, cumin, and one stick of red dried chili. And the most important part, I would say, is a generous spring of curry leaves. This is another staple, I would say. I always grew up. There was always curry leaves in the house.
Is it popping?
Yeah, I just love that sound.
I'm getting some of it.
Yeah. So that sounds like, to me, my mother's kitchen.
Yeah.
So this is looking, I think, quite nice. Ah.
Smells good.
Yeah. And that's all you really need to do is just to get the oil and things all kind of fused together. Yeah, the smell of the chili, the cumin, and mustard seeds in action. Yeah, that's all smelling really, really good. It's too bad that we can never transmit smells through audio.
I agree, but people can definitely
try it.
Try it at home.
Yeah.
You won't regret it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And this would be poured over what we have, which is the peripheral curry. It's looking good.
Do you want to taste it first before we...
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe just before we add the tempering.
Okay, so we need to do something to it. We can always pop it back.
Mmm, that's delicious. You can really taste that undertone of coconut milk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why if you really like it, you could also like put more. So I would just... That looks pretty.
Oh, that's sizzling.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
I do like the mustard seed. Yeah, it is a bit warm.
Yeah, and you can really smell the coconut milk in it, too. It just gives it a beautiful, fragrant aroma. Sweet a little bit.
It's like distinctively smells like coconut. Yeah.
Mmm.
I realized that I forgot to put a little bit of ginger, but that's fine.
It still tastes amazing.
Yeah. Yum. Yeah, so this is like a version of what my mother would make. Sometimes my mother will put in spinach or other like leafy things in it to the boiling process.
It tastes delicious. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing this with me.
Yeah, no, I'm glad, happy to be able to talk about it.
So we're just about to eat some of this beautiful, and is it called parapur?
Yeah, parapur curry. So this is different because we're eating it like a soup, which is not something that I grew up doing. Right. But it's also fun.
Yeah, I grew up eating like dal or lentils always with rice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But often we would just eat that on its own. Like sometimes there would be meat in the dal, like often meat and potatoes, but I never wanted to eat the meat. I would only eat the dal and the potatoes.
So you would have it all together.
Mm-hmm. I also wonder if that's like an adaptation or innovation for convenience for people who want to make one thing and not several, right?
Mm-hmm.
I love the texture of the mustard seeds. Like it just adds something else to it.
Yeah. Mm. And I also do think because of the way that the coconut milk and the turmeric interact, it's not like the coconut milk is overpowering. It just kind of lifts the flavor profiles or maybe does some binding work.
I think it does too. I can feel some of the heat, but it's like welcome and warm and not overwhelming.
Yeah, which I'm happy that we didn't put too much cayenne.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, you talked about your mom being in her 20s and that's how she learned how to cook in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to, you mentioned that you came here when you were how old?
I had my 6th birthday in Montreal, so I was like 5. And also the other interesting part of that story is that I met my dad for the first time in Montreal when I was 5 years old.
Wow.
So my dad had essentially, his father was a captain, and I think he was the first Sri Lankan Tamil captain in Sri Lanka working for the European colonizers. But I don't think my dad ended up into that, but a lot of the men at the time would work on ships, import-export ships that would go to like Singapore, Malaysia, Vancouver to New York. And so my dad used to do that. And he got to Vancouver one time, and then from Vancouver, and this blows my mind to this day, he made his way from Vancouver to Montreal. His brother-in-law, my mom's older brother, was there already. And from there, he ultimately sponsored us because we were in the north where the war was. And so for people who don't know, there was a civil war going on in Sri Lanka from kind of the 1980s, and it finished in 2009. I was born in 86 and my sister was born in 83. And those were the heights of the civil war. So it's also wild to be thinking that you're like they're caught in the middle of the war. And so my dad would come and go as a lot of the other men did, but it was harder to be getting into the north ultimately because you'd still have to go through the capital city, the port city, and make your way up. And then my mom, who was there not only responsible for her 3 now very young children she had, me at the time, like literally a month after she had given birth to me, and then her own siblings and her father, they escaped overnight ultimately. And I grew up hearing stories where one time my mom had told me that the army had caught them because the Indian army was in there and the Sri Lankan army was in there and the Tamil Tigers, which are seen as these in, like separatist organization, which people talk about as being terrorist, were also in the north. And so in that kind of conflict, my mom tells this one story where I think I'm about 1 month old and she's just like, imagine having given birth and just a month old. She and all of her family, so her siblings and the 3 kids were lined up to be shot. And then so something happened and she still to this day kind of claims it to be divine intervention, where just as they were about to like shoot all of us, some army sergeant came and said, we have to go somewhere else. And then, so they left everything ultimately and then went an overnight train. And from the north, they got to Colombo. And so we were in Colombo internally displaced because of the civil war, which a lot of Sri Lankan Tamils were at the time. And then because my dad had this exit because he was working on the ship, went to Montreal. And in those days, in the late 80s and early 90s, getting kind of immigration papers was still procedurally difficult, but not as difficult as it is today. And so he claimed PR, and then from PR sponsored us. And then my mom, speaking no English, got on a plane with 3 young girls. There was a Catholic priest that she traveled with. I remember it was KLM, and he got to, I don't know if it was Amsterdam. So it was only halfway. So she had somebody to be with her who speaks the language halfway of the leg, and then the second half to Montreal. We landed in Montreal, Pierre Trudeau Airport, and that was the first time I met my dad. So I was like, wow. And so I remember I was really confused by the cold air coming out of my mouth because, you know, I grew up in a tropical place and all of a sudden I'm in the airport or a completely different place, plucked from all of the things that I grew up with. And then meeting my father for the first time and my father also seeing my mother after, you know, 5-6 years ultimately. I think because of the work I do, I'm able to think about it and process it and talk about it like very rationally. But growing up as a settler, someone who's displaced from a civil war, there was no language for any of my experiences. So I'm like very, even though my relationship with my parents is complicated, like all, you know, children who grow up in like bicultural homes or immigrant communities or families, I still am like aware of like, wow, to be 28, which is how old my mother was when she had me, to rely on a man who is overseas and then to get on a plane with three young girls. And so we were all girls too, right? And it would be different if there were, I think if there were boys involved. My aunt had a harder time with her boys because the government often see them also as terrorists, as part of the organization. So they were heavily surveilled. So it was really complicated. And so now that I'm older, I do this for a living and I talk about a lot of these things in very important ways with other parallel communities, not often with my own. I think I have a better language to even say the things I've just said. Which are not easy to say, yeah. So when I was like 16 or 12 or 13, these are not things that we talk about at home, right? Because our parents don't. I'm very cautious or wary with my parents because I'm like, I don't know the degree to which they have trauma that they haven't, like they have seen things, right?
Yeah, and they haven't had the space or time to process that because they've just been focused on surviving and taking care of the family, right?
Mm-hmm. And putting food on the table. So I think my mom, a lot of my memories of my mother was her in the kitchen making sure we were fed. I think really seriously about the food she makes now, knowing her story and probably knowing I don't know a lot of her story either, right? So that's kind of the context of my own upbringing, how I got to Canada, how we were forced to leave Sri Lanka, and why I think about a lot of the questions I think about very seriously, yeah. We're eating it with naan and it's also really good too.
It's delicious, yeah. I do think that lentils go with everything. And this is sort of confirming that.
Yeah.
I'm just still feeling the staggering number that you said that the civil war in Sri Lanka started sometime in the 80s and kind of went till 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a 25 to 30 year period that a civil war took place. So your family left at a certain point, right? And like, I guess if you were six, that must have been 92?
We came to Toronto, I think 91, 92. Okay. Yeah.
Right. So your family and your parents lived through years in a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
I know I can't comprehend that, but what does that do to everyday life?
Growing up, I think I often was very frustrated with my parents being like, why don't you get it? Or language that I would use now is like, why are you disassociated? Or why are you hyper anxious? Or like, why are these things super triggering? And now that I'm older and have still a complicated understanding of those stuff, I'm like, oh, like you have a lot of unprocessed trauma and like trauma upon trauma, right? Of like losing a mother at very young age, becoming a mother to your siblings. My mom's youngest brother, 7, he was kidnapped. And so because they thought, again, he was part of the terrorist organization. And so they had kidnapped him. And so I remember hearing stories from my aunts and my mom saying that they were running on the streets looking for their brother who was taken. I guess whoever took him, I don't know if the government did, released him because they realized he wasn't part of the militant organization that was fighting against the state. And then they had to take him and hide him in a church. And so a bishop hid him in the church. They tell me these stories and I'm just like, what? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, there's so many layers,
to
what your family went through.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I know it has caught. I mean, I was born into this, but I was very young. And so my sense of memory is very different. And the intergenerational trauma of it is very different. And a somatic level, I know if I was... this was the world into which I entered that obviously has impacted my body.
Yeah.
But there's like actual no physical, like there's few memories, like the ones that I'm relaying, but a lot of it is also like memories that has been passed. And so when I hear about intergenerational trauma that, and this is not at all parallel, but with Indigenous communities or Black communities or Jewish communities or Palestinian communities, I'm just like, I have a sense of it because this is what trauma does. It's like carries in your body. But this is how it also works through family that I'm sure I don't have children, but my siblings do, that it's also inherited to them, even though they were born here. So there's things that I think our bodies hold that continue to be transmitted. I'm like very aware and attuned to it now, again, because I'm doing the work to think about it. But I do feel very sad knowing that my mom will never have the opportunity to kind of do that deep work. But the other flip side of this is I was the first one in my family to go back to my ancestral home right at the end of the war in 2001. And I was very foolish about this return because I was living in London at the time and got it in my head that I should go back to the north. And the state, the military had just started opening the borders to move when the war had ended officially, technically in 2009. And I went in 2011 and I was so stupid because I didn't really think about it. I was very naive. I was like, oh, whatever. And I remember my mom had called, and I was living in England at the time. She called and said, I barely got you out of that country in my arms. Why would you even willingly go back there? So I knew that was a moment where real panic set in for her, and that was super triggering for her. Her youngest child to be like, I'm going to go to Sri Lanka for a visit, right? Because I thought that's something that you do. And then every step of the way, she would frantically call. And then she would say, well, you just go to the capital city, you don't go to the north. And then my cousin was like, well, we're going to take you to the north because they just opened the military border and you may never get the chance to go again. And so I think that overnight bus ride where you take, it's like a 10-hour bus ride from Colombo to go to the north, was one of the most harrowing experiences of my life, because you're, as the sun is rising, the bus is going into the north where it's been war-torn for 3 decades almost. And that was the first time I had seen what a war-torn place is. Charred palm trees, coconut trees that we've just spoken about, emptied houses, bullet holes, all of these things. And so that was a moment that I started, in the language I would use now, is disassociating. I was like, this is real. Like, I heard stories, but this is real, right? And then we crossed the causeway because there's an archipelago of islands in the north, and Kites is the island that we were from and I was born on and my grandfather's house is. And so my cousin, without telling my mother, had taken me, and I was the first one to step back into that house out of all of our family. And I remember going to where my mother cooked a dish like this into the back, which was just like an outdoor stove where you would manually light fire. And there were bullet casings everywhere, and there was bunk bunkers behind it. And I just remember standing there being like, holy shit, like this was the reality of what my mother had cooked in. And it was interesting because my cousin had said, I need you to stay behind me because there's still landmines everywhere. And so these things are popping up, and I just completely was like, I did not think this through. And then I'm caught now aware of what my mother was worried about. Her legitimate panic of me going back into this country that, as she said, I barely got you out of there. Why would you go back in there? Because that was her last memories of those places. But I also remember the sound of the ocean. Mm. So standing in this bullet-ridden kitchen area that my mother would have cooked in, my mother's old kitchen, and to hear the ocean and the sound of the water at the back, and to know that my body also viscerally responded to that as like probably the first sounds I ever heard as an infant who entered into the world. There was something also quite powerful about that. And I was standing in my grandfather's house, the first person in our family to stand in that house after being displaced from it. At that point, I would have been 24 years old, I think. That was intense. And my grandfather at the time was living in Scarborough. And so I knew the severe intensity of that moment to have been able to sit on the porch. And remember, I had collected a few seashells because I wanted to give to him. Despite all the war and like tragedy of the place, it's always also reminded that this was a house my grandfather built by himself with his own hands. The sadness of all this is a few days later, I was in India visiting with my cousins, and my mom called to say that my grandfather had just died. So I think it was also interesting to be like, there was this deep opening of he waited till I got back to his house and then he passed away in Scarborough. And I think that's when I was like, oh, there's a lot of things that have been given to me to process what this return has been. My mother's trauma and her real suffering, the world that I was born into, but also a lot of the really interesting religious and cultural phenomena that now I spend my life studying. And so that's been an interesting gift I hold very close to my heart.
I think that you said so much in there, and I just want to say thank you for sharing all of that. It's a gift that you shared it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dal Project. Follow me on Instagram at Dal Project. Dal is spelt D-A-A-L. Intro and exit music are excerpts from the song Creep by Lal. Thanks for tuning in.